Earlier this week, the government warned that many doctors are prescribing antidepressants with a false sense of security. Patients just starting antidepressants or changing their dosage are sometimes vulnerable to suicidal thoughts, the warning said, and need to be monitored carefully. We'll have more on this warning in just a minute, but we also wanted to expand the conversation to talk about the history of treatments for depression. Just a few years ago, antidepressant drugs like Prozac seemed to promise a magic bullet that would free millions from their demons. Well, it does work for many, but many are still looking for effective treatments or remain untreated altogether. Later in the program, an idyllic trip through the Canadian wilderness with canoe, backpack, and satellite telephone. But first, is Prozac Nation crumbling? How do healthcare costs affect how we treat depression? And what about earlier treatments like electroshock and Freudian analysis? Join the conversation. If depression runs in your family, can you trace different generations of treatment? And what about the social stigma? Are we more understanding of depression these days? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR health correspondent Joanne Silberner. Always nice to have you on the show, Joanne.
Nice to be here.
Tell us more about the latest government's findings on use of antidepressant drugs.
Well, they're really basically buying time. What they're asking the manufacturers to do is to put warning statements on these drugs, saying that people on the drugs need to be closely followed and evaluated. They're not saying yet that they think that there's a real problem. They're saying that the data are so confusing and so voluminous that, you know, the data have been provided to them to the drug companies. They're still going through it. They've actually turned it over to a group at Columbia University to try and analyze. These are hard numbers to understand. They're hard numbers to know whether or not to act on, because these drugs, if they do lead to suicides in some cases, they also clearly lead to the alleviation of depression in other cases. So how do you balance it out? They just don't have enough data right now. They want doctors to follow their patients carefully while they analyze the data.
You'd think suicides would be fairly easy to count.
You would, and they're actually, thankfully, rare enough so that they're having trouble achieving statistical significance. So what they've been looking at is what they call suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts. Now that, the numbers are huge in kids. 20% of teenagers think about suicide. So if you put a kid on if you put a kid with depression onto one of these drugs and they're thinking about suicide, is it because they're a normal teenage kid? Is it because their depression is making them think about suicide? Or is it because the drug is making them think about suicide? Trying to tease that apart is a real challenge statistically.
I can understand that. So what happens next with FDA warnings?
Well, they're buying time, as I said. What they're going to do is they're going to have another meeting. The Columbia University group is busy going through the data from all the drug companies. They're trying to categorize them the same way so that they can count things. Each drug company that submitted data to the FDA submitted it in its own way, counted things in its own way. So what they're trying to do is, let's try and get this into one table. We can look at the table. We can understand things. They're going to have another meeting this summer. Whether or not they're going to come out with a final decision at that point, I don't know.
Another finding is that more and more of the physicians prescribing antidepressants aren't psychiatrists, but primary care physicians. I understand that's one of those good news, bad news kind of a deals.
The good news is that most people have a primary physician. Most people have access to a primary physician. One of the big issues with depression is lack of treatment. Is people, you know, because of stigma, they don't want to go in, or because there's not they live in a rural area with no psychiatrist, they don't want to go in, or their insurance company doesn't pay for a whole lot of psychiatric visits. So having the primary care docs take care of them really expands the accessibility to treatment. The concern is, are the primary care docs going to do the things that the FDA is asking? You know, having people come back after they put them on the drug, have them come back right away, you know, within the first week or month, to make sure that things are going all right, or to change things if they're not. The primary care docs, a lot of psychiatrists fear, and of course, you know, there might be some professional jealousy there, but their fear is that the primary care docs won't do the follow-up the psychiatrists do, also won't do the therapy that seems to help these drugs work a lot.
So if there's an increased risk of suicide or suicidal thoughts, it may be because these primary care physicians aren't following up enough. Is that the suggestion?
Well, that's what some psychiatrists are saying that, or that it won't be noticed, that if there's a problem, it won't be noticed as quickly. You know, a psychiatrist may have sooner follow-up visits, is really going to, it's like with any specialist, they're going to focus in on the problem very closely. You know, again, the data on this, you can't point to data and say either group is better. You know, there's the access issue, that's great. There's the follow-up issue, that's unknown.
Now, remind us, so we're going to be talking about the history of treatments for depression. When did this, we tend to say Prozac, but it's one of a family of drugs. When did they first come into play here?
They really came in the 80s and in the 90s. And if you are looking at suicide rate, especially in kids, suicide rates were going up from about 1955 to 1995. They really increased dramatically. In 1995, they started dropping, in fact, very dramatically. You know, they're not down to what they were in the mid-50s when it was probably underdiagnosed or underrecognized. So, you know, they've come down in teens. Is that because of the drugs or despite the drugs?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Do these drugs work for most people most of the time?
Absolutely, yeah. You know, they do, and that's the big problem. You don't want to take away these drugs that are clearly helping. You know, absolutely proven in adults. In kids, the data are a little bit messy, and that may be an issue of prescribing. Are they being prescribed to the right kids? Are they being prescribed at the right doses? It's not the numbers aren't as clear in kids. But in adults, yes, they absolutely help. And, you know, again, the issue with depression is undertreatment. The numbers that you see, or lack of treatment, lack of diagnosis, the most common number I've come across is that half of adults with serious depression are not properly treated, either because they don't get diagnosed or the treatment is incorrect. And this is a debilitating, seriously debilitating disease that costs, you know, a lot in heartache and a lot to businesses that lose people, you know, working. And it's, you know, it's an awful disease that needs fixing just as much as a heart attack does.
And it may be approaching heart conditions as a common disease. I mean, this is an awful lot of people we're talking about, isn't it?
Absolutely. Something like, if I have my numbers right, it's something like 20 million Americans a year have depression.
Now, how much does the cost of treatment affect the way doctors direct patients towards pharmaceuticals instead of maybe saying we should sit down and have a nice long talk with your psychiatrist once a week?
Well, the ideal treatment is both, and payment for both. Well, you know, this all gets down to insurance, and this gets back to the issue of the primary care docs. You know, most insurance policies don't have full coverage for mental illness. So they'll pay for you if you have depression and you go to your doctor with a depression-related illness, because this can show up as heart disease, it can show up as other things. Most insurance all insurance policies really will pay for the heart disease. They won't pay for the underlying depression that's leading to it. But if your doctor in treating the heart disease notices the depression, well, then, you know, you're going to get treated along with that. So payment does direct how things are done. In an ideal world, what would be covered is both the diagnosis, the treatment, and, you know, the drug treatment, and also a little bit of talk therapy, which has been shown to help in combination with the drugs.
Let's see if we get a phone call in. Greg is on the line with us from Indianapolis.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a tremendous fan of Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you.
I wanted to ask about what is it that we know, what is known about the ability of people to get off of depression medication. My own wife has been in a situation where, you know, we lost medical coverage recently, and she's kind of taken herself off this medication because it just was not affordable to us without some drug coverage. She seems to be doing very well, actually, so I'm not too concerned about her at this time, but I guess I'm wondering, is this typical, or is this something like diabetes, where once you're on this medication, you're pretty much on it the rest of your life?
Joanne, don't want to diagnose over the radio.
Yeah. I also don't have an MD. But I think, you know, there's so many different kinds of depression, so many different levels of depression, so many different causes for depression. Some depression's episodic, comes back. Some doesn't come back again. In any one particular case, it's really hard to say.
Greg, thanks for the call. Good question.
Thank you.
Wish we had a better answer.
Well, I know it's difficult. Thank you so much.
And thanks to NPR's Joanne Silberner for being with us here in Studio 3A.
Thank you.
Joanne Silberner is NPR's health correspondent. And joining us now is Andrew Solomon. He's the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, which won a 2001 National Book Award. In the book, Solomon explains the biology and treatments of depression, as well as the sociology of depression. And he joins us now from our bureau in New York. Nice of you to be with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
50 years ago, I understand, a depression entered the physician's diagnostic manual. What were the common treatments for it half a century ago?
Half a century ago, there was an awareness that it was necessary to find chemical treatments, but those treatments didn't exist. And so what mostly existed were talking cures, all of which were derived at least loosely from Freud, the idea that you tried to get at the internal conflicts that might be causing someone to be depressed. You tried to figure out whether they had unexpressed hatred that was being turned in on themselves, so on and so forth.
Now, there are some who say there's sort of a fundamental trap with Freudian analysis and depression.
I think Freudian analysis can be very illuminating about depression. It's not always so effective in curing it. There's been a problem altogether in the discourse around depression about trying to separate the chemical from the psychological. And in fact, the chemical and the psychological are two ways of describing the same phenomenon. And so we find that if you treat someone with talking therapies, that can bring about chemical changes in their brain. And if you treat someone with medications, that can bring about changes in the way that they feel and the way that they describe themselves. So Freudian therapy said they weren't able to identify very clearly and specifically what kinds of processes would help with depression. We're nonetheless able to alleviate it to some extent in some people.
Okay. Obviously, though, the disease was described this way for the first time half a century ago. It clearly existed a long time before that. Take us through history a little bit, if you would, and tell us how people described depression and what they did about it.
Well, depression has been around as long as people have been around, and Hippocrates actually described it in the 5th century BC as a condition in which sadness, anxiety, moral dejection, tendency to suicide, aversion to food, despondency, sleeplessness, irritability, and restlessness were accompanied by prolonged fear. So that's really pretty much the same definition that you find in modern psychiatric manuals.
And what did he tell you to do about it?
He said that it was an organic dysfunction of the brain and that it should be treated with oral remedies. So he had the idea of antidepressants. He just didn't have the antidepressants themselves. He tried a variety of herbs and prescribed mostly hellebores, which were a cathartic. And at the same time, Plato was arguing that the problem of depression was actually a philosophical problem. And so he was really the father, in a way, of the talking therapies that have since come down to us. And the two of them argued about it quite vigorously. Then as the ancient world gave way to the medieval world, there began to be a stigma associated with depression, which in the ancient world people had no problem talking about. And in the medieval world, there was the suggestion that illnesses were illnesses either of the body or of the soul, and that depression was an illness of the soul. And an illness of the soul was seen as a mark of God's disfavor. And in some instances, depression was seen as an indication that you didn't believe in ultimate redemption and was therefore sacrilege, so that during the Inquisition you could actually be imprisoned or possibly even executed for being depressed.
So this is in addition to, the depression can lead to a lot of people having difficulty doing things like getting out of bed. So you could see that there were moral strictures, you lazy bum, you. Added to that, the spiritual condemnation of the church?
Absolutely. And frequently, the medieval word for depression is acidy, and it's frequently used to mean sloth as well. So there was a sense that depression was a laziness.
What was that word again?
Acidia.
Acidia, yeah. As in acid.
Yes.
Okay. This pretty much persisted until the time of Freud, do you think?
Well, the Renaissance then glamorized depression and thought that people who were depressed had a more profound understanding of human nature than other people and saw the depressed artist as a splendid and romantic figure.
May not have agreed.
And then as time went on, science really began to come into descriptions of mental illnesses in the 18th and 19th centuries. And that was when people began trying to understand these as clinical illnesses, though you're right that depression was not described in the American psychiatric manuals until the 1950s. By the 1880s, the work of Emil Kraepelin had brought the idea of depression as an illness with specific parameters into the mainstream.
We're speaking with Andrew Solomon. He's the author of The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. When we come back from a break, we'd like more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing treatment for depression throughout the ages, from prayer to diet to shock therapy to talk therapy. Our guest is Andrew Solomon, the author of The Noonday Demon. And, of course, you're invited to join us. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. And let's begin with a caller. Cynthia joins us from Pester, California.
Hello?
Hello, Cynthia. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had more a comment than a question. My mother was a lifelong alcoholic, and I kind of spent a lot of years puzzling over, and a very sad, distressed person on top of it. And I spent a lot of time puzzling over whether her depression was caused by her alcoholism or her alcoholism by her depression. And my sisters and I kind of figured out that it was likely that she'd suffered from a lifelong clinical depression and was alcoholic as a result of that. She was never diagnosed, to my knowledge, as being depressed. She kept lots of doctors in business over the years, but I do remember at one point when I was fairly young, I remember her being treated with tranquilizers. But that's the only medication I remember her ever being given. And I just...
And when would that have been, Cynthia?
Oh, gosh. It was probably in about the early 60s.
Andrew Solomon, the alcoholism, depression, chicken and egg, right?
Yes, the two things lead to one another. If you're depressed, that gives you a motivation for drinking. If you're drinking, your life falls apart and pushes you deeper into depression. There's been a somewhat sadistic tendency in the alcohol treatment movement in the United States to insist that the alcoholism has to be dealt with before the depression. And in fact, frequently, if you're really depressed, it makes it much harder to deal with the alcoholism. The sane and the humane thing to do is to treat both things in tandem.
And Cynthia's other point, that her mother was at one point treated with tranquilizers. Do you remember the particular drug, Cynthia?
I don't.
But something like Milltown or something like that?
Oh, do you know, I remember the name Milltown now that you mention it, yes.
Well, S.J. Perelman remembers it too. What about you, Andrew Solomon? Was that a treatment in the 50s at one point?
That was a treatment in the 50s. Unfortunately, tranquilizers are still frequently prescribed by family physicians to patients who complain of depression. And tranquilizers are not an appropriate response to depression. They just make you feel depressed and really tired.
It certainly didn't help her at all, no.
Cynthia, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. As you were talking about the 50s, when depression was first described in the American, what was the preferred treatment then?
In the 50s, the preferred treatments were talking therapies, but by the late 50s and the early 60s, the use of the chemical antidepressants began. The first antidepressant was discovered really by accident. There were people who had tuberculosis who were being treated with the drug, which turned out not to be very helpful to their tuberculosis, but it elevated their mood enormously.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, the drug began to be used for the treatment of depression. And electroshock was also a frequent treatment really from the 1920s on and remains a very effective treatment today. In fact, electroshock is the most effective treatment we have for depression. It works on more people than medication does.
And yet, if you talked about, if you asked most people to name a discredited psychiatric therapy, they would say electroshock.
Movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest gave people a very horrible idea of what electroshock was. And in fact, the process was still quite primitive in the 20s and 30s and even into the 50s and 60s. At this point, electroshock treatments are given under sedation. The electrical impulse is a fraction of a second. It induces a brain seizure, which lasts less than 30 seconds. It's a much more benign process. It's still not pleasant. And people obviously would prefer to take medications, and that's an easier thing to do first. And if you respond to the medications, terrific. But it is a very effective treatment, and it is in wide use in the United States.
Here's an email we got from Marjorie Torelli in Canandaigua, New York. My aunt was not treated for depression and resulting anorexia. We didn't even have a name for that latter disorder. When I heard the description years after her death, I recognized it immediately. She died in 1973. My mother was treated with a drug for years. Finally, when she began to suffer from symptoms of other disorders, my brother monitored her prescription and found that her doctor had overprescribed the treatment for probably 20 years. When life events triggered my depression, I was prescribed Paxil. I took the medication for 5 years. I also participated in counseling for around 2 years. When my life was more manageable and I was better, I stopped taking the drug about 6 months ago. Does that sound like a family history that's not out of whack with what many Americans have experienced the past 50 years or so?
It does. And I'm struck by the fact that she's describing inappropriate treatment for depression and that the previous caller was describing the tranquilizers, which were an inappropriate treatment for depression. Unfortunately, there's a great deal of incompetent psychiatric care out there. And a lot of the time people get an inappropriate treatment, or they get a medication at the wrong dose, or they get something else wrong. And because the symptoms are so nebulous, it's sometimes hard for people to know whether they're getting good treatment or not getting good treatment. I think the FDA regulations that inspired this discussion today are really designed to push people toward getting more close, more attentive treatment. And if they work, ideally, hopefully, what they will do is to curtail the activities of doctors who prescribe inappropriate medications or prescribe them in an inappropriate way.
And one of the things we keep talking about is treatments. There are a variety, as we've suggested, different kinds of approaches that various people talk about. But on the other hand, do we know what causes depression?
I think depression is the interaction between a genetic vulnerability and external circumstances. Some people are extremely vulnerable to depression genetically, and so they have a very small difficulty in their life, and it just pushes them over the edge. Other people are not basically very subject to depression at all, but if they go through an enormous trauma, then that will start the depression. And once the depression begins, it takes off on its own chemically. But our understanding of what goes on in the brain is really still quite limited. We know that the neurotransmitters are implicated. We know that treatments which raise levels of neurotransmitters, especially serotonin, will help to bring about a resolution of the depression. But what exactly the mechanisms are by which it gets underway and what exactly has gone wrong in the brain when it's depressed, we still can't really say.
And is it, we keep finding new ways of describing depression. Are we talking about different ways of describing one thing, or are people coming to the conclusion that there are depressions?
There's no question that there are depressions. Historically, the tendency was to separate endogenous depression, which was depression that came internally from no external stimulus, from depression which was caused by a traumatic event. That distinction is broken down. But now people talk about depression, they talk about bipolar illness, they talk about a lot now bipolar 2, which means that you have extreme depression and then non-psychotic mania or hypomania. There's a constant reclassifying of things. In fact, a lot of our classifications now are based on the drugs. If you take certain drugs and have certain responses to them, then people say, okay, you're in this diagnostic category. If you take other drugs and have other responses, they put you in another category. But I think the resolution of what really constitutes depression or what the different kinds of depression are, that's a job that we have ahead of us.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. This is Suzanne, who's with us from Ithaca, New York.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I'm an acupuncturist, and I treat a lot of people with different kinds of depression, and we don't separate the emotional and the chemical.
So you treat them both at the same time?
Well, you can't. Like, depression is a physiological and emotional thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we treat it, like, it's either what we call liver qi stagnation or heart heat or something like that, or in the case of postpartum depression, it's usually a blood deficiency.
So obviously different treatments for different kinds of depression. And Suzanne, how does it work for your patients?
Really well. I've gotten great responses. I've a lot of trouble with bipolar, though.
Mm-hmm. Andrew Solomon, how long has acupuncture been used as a treatment for depression?
Acupuncture has been used for emotional distress for a long time. I can't give you an actual date, but hundreds of years. The use of acupuncture for extreme mental illness does seem to have some effects. There are an enormous number of so-called alternative treatments that are out there. And when I first started writing my book on depression, I was quite a medical conservative. But having worked on it for a long time, I've met people who are helped by things that seem preposterous. I've met people who are helped by alternative therapies that have a strong historical base, like acupuncture. And I met people who are helped only by medications. Mm-hmm. And my view at this point is do whatever helps you to get better.
Suzanne, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. And I have to ask you, Andrew, you speak from experience here, don't you?
I do, yes. I've suffered from depression for most of my life.
And how does it manifest itself in you?
Well, when it gets really out of control, I feel lethargic. I always say the opposite of depression is not happiness, but vitality. And I sort of lose all of my vitality. Everything becomes difficult and heavy and effortful. I find it hard to get out of bed. I feel isolated and like nothing in the world matters, and I feel unable to cope with the most ordinary things. I think about eating and the idea of cutting the food up and putting it in my mouth and chewing it and swallowing it all seems completely overwhelming and horrifying to me.
And what have you tried in terms of treatment and what it seems to be working, whatever it is you're trying now?
I have had a combination of medication and psychotherapy, and I think, as was said earlier in the show, that the combination is much more potent than either thing alone. The medication, I think, redressed some of the chemical imbalance, and the psychotherapy has helped me understand what the things are that trigger my depressions, how to control them, how to make sense out of myself in the wake of a chemical intervention, what it really means to be me and to be depressed. Mm-hmm. In the course of working on my book, I went and tried lots of alternative therapies and found lots of interesting kinds of treatment. But my response has really been a combination of medication and talking therapy.
Now, at the same time that we're talking about treatments that are for most people, most of the time, much more effective at treating depression than we had in the old days, and that's talking about the families of antidepressant drugs, there are seeming to be a lot more people who are depressed than ever before.
There's no question that two things have changed. One is that people identify depression much more. When there was no good treatment for depression, it didn't accomplish anything for you to say you were depressed. You might as well keep it to yourself. You might as well try not to think about it. Now that we have so many effective treatments for depression, people are much more likely to think about their mood state and say, gee, maybe I'm depressed and maybe I should do something about it.
So better recognition is just a part of it.
Much better recognition. But there's no question that the rates of actual depression are escalating, and there have been dozens and dozens of reasons proposed that the world is overpopulated, that people are more alienated from the people around them, the breakdown of village societies, all kinds of things have been put forward. Nobody really knows for sure, but it is on the up.
So Prozac Nation was never accurate to any great degree. Depression Nation, maybe.
Yes, exactly. Misery Nation.
Misery Nation. As we continue to find that it seems to be increasing for, as you suggested, a couple of reasons, is there more research going on to find out what exactly the mechanism, the genetic mechanism, that predisposes some people towards certain kinds of depression is?
There's a lot of work being done on the genetics, and there have been some promising results. There are some genes that have been located that seem to be related to depression and some genes that seem to be related to bipolar or manic depressive illness. The problem is that depression, by and large, I think, is not the result of a single depression gene. It's the result of a particular mode of interaction of many, many different genes, all of which have other functions as well, and then the way that those genes interact with the environment. So it's not going to be easy and straightforward, the mapping process, but it is underway.
And also, so this is confused. Obviously, we were talking earlier about its interrelationship with alcoholism. That is not the only condition where there's a seeming chicken and the egg situation with depression.
There's no question that a lot of people manifest physical symptoms when what they really have is depression. There's no question that people who are depressed have a much lower state of physical health. And there's also a lot of confusion around the edges of depression and schizophrenia and sort of how it touches on lots of other things. But if you're depressed, your physical health is likely to be much lower. And frequently, it's more efficient to treat the depression than to keep treating the physical symptoms. But unfortunately, the structure of insurance in this country causes treatment to be more readily available for the physical symptoms.
We're speaking with Andrew Solomon, the author of Noonday Demon. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I was just going to follow up on that. We raised the question of insurance coverage with Joanne Silberner when she was here. You raise it again.
Yes, I think it's shocking how difficult it is to get adequate treatment for mental illness. And though there has been legislation put forward any number of times to try to establish real parity so that the same degree of coverage you have for physical illness would exist for mental illness, those attempts haven't been successful. And their primary exponent, Paul Wellstone, of course, died a couple of years ago. The treatment of depression is still seen somehow as a luxury rather than as a necessity. And so we have huge numbers of people who are suffering from a terrible, devastating illness, an illness that should be added, which frequently has a fatal outcome. About 6% of people with major depression will end up committing suicide. So it's a very, very serious illness. And the fact that we've allowed the insurance lobby to prevent us from giving adequate coverage for it is shocking.
Let's get another caller on the line. Becky's with us from Akron, Ohio.
Yes, I was just calling to make a comment on the fact that, in retrospect, I've probably been depressed since I was six, sought treatment in my 30s, finally got somebody to listen to me and put me on medication. And the advantage of that was, I believe in our family it's hereditary, and I was able to intervene when my children became teenagers and recognize the symptoms and get them treatment. My son was easier to treat than our daughter, but we stuck with her, and today she's a 22-year-old. She's on medication. She's blossomed. She has a child. She's happy, and I think it's important for parents, you know, to recognize what those signs are of depression in their children and make sure that they take a proactive participation.
Andrew Solomon, has that been an important part of education about depression?
It's extremely important. And people sometimes say, well, my kid is young and maybe he'll sort of work it through on his own, and I'm not sure I really want to get started with medication. But the fact of the matter is that if you bring someone out of a depression fairly rapidly at an early stage when they're young and are first experiencing those symptoms, they can go on to have a good and rewarding life like the one that was just being described. If you don't treat depression over a long period of time, it tends to get worse, it tends to get more intractable, it tends to get more profound. So an awareness of what's going on with your kids is incredibly important. And if they begin to show signs of what seems like depression, getting them appropriate treatment can really save their lives.
Becky, we wish you and your daughter the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. And this is Ben, who's with us from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to know about, I guess I have major depression, and I've had a really hard time holding down a job. And even in the times when I was capable of working, you always have to go in and fill out the application. And boy, my application looks like Swiss cheese in terms of what's on there and what's not on there. So, I mean, I guess it comes down to, again, it's sort of a self-esteem issue in terms of, geez, I don't feel really that good about talking about this, but I need to in order to explain the gaps in my resume.
Either that or CIA hitman. That's explained
exactly.
The absence.
Yeah, good idea. Try that next time.
Yeah, I'm afraid, Andrew Solomon, we just have a few seconds left. But is there any advice you can give Ben?
I think it's very difficult to deal with that issue with employers, and depending on the field, you'll encounter more or less prejudice about it. But I think if you can be honest and open, and if you can say, I've had depressive episodes, but I am now in treatment and I'm now functioning well and don't anticipate being out of commission again, then you're all set.
Ben, good luck.
Thanks.
Okay. And Andrew Solomon, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Andrew Solomon joined us from our bureau in New York. His book is The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. When we come back from a short break, up the creek with a paddle and a sat phone. Is a high-tech phone the right choice for a backwoods canoeing trip in the solitude of the wilderness? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.